have our final session with Rod, who is returning to be our session speaker for this afternoon. I was trying to think of some fitting way to introduce Rod this time, given that I introduced him last night. And to mind came the memory of the popular Christian singer from many years ago, Keith Green. How many of you remember Keith, right? I remember being at a Keith Green concert, and the guy who introduced Keith Green stood up and said, "He's a modern-day prophet," and, you know, invoking the memory of Elijah and Jeremiah. And then, of course, the following week, Keith started coming out with comments about the Pope being the Antichrist and some really embarrassing things, and we all shuddered. And I thought, okay, I'm not going to say that Rod is a modern-day prophet. Nonetheless, it's interesting to me to think of a man raised in the United Methodist Church, turned Roman Catholic, turned Orthodox, calling the evangelical church to reform in the 21st century. I think that's a sufficient a basis for introducing you again, Rod. So please come and lead us in the session. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Joel. And I hope that this session, that the last session of the day, will be profitable, because I'm talking about something that means a lot to me, which is art and architecture and film. I'm going to talk about the filmmaker Terrence Malick, who is not everybody's cup of tea, but I hope that some of you, if you've never heard of him or seen his movies, will be inspired to go watch this particular movie because of this lecture. Some readers of the Benedict Option have asked why I use an image of the Abbey of Mont Saint-Michel on the cover. That medieval French abbey sits on an island in a shallow tidal bay just off the coast of Normandy. The French call the abbey La Merveille, which means the wonder. In this talk, I'm going to explain why Mont Saint-Michel is, to my mind, an apt symbol of what I mean about the Benedict Option, even though I wrote the book as a call not only to Roman Catholics, but to all Christians living in the West. And let me make it clear here at the outset that though I speak to you, as Joel said, as a convert to Eastern Orthodoxy from Roman Catholicism, I will exclude Orthodoxy and Catholicism from the bounds of my remarks today. But please don't interpret my silence about those two communions as implying that those churches are without challenges. You know, we certainly have them, absolutely. I am speaking, however, at a Protestant evangelical seminary at a conference about the Reformation, so I've directed my comments accordingly. It's true that Mont Saint-Michel can be fairly seen as a symbol of what the Reformers rebelled against, the mindset of medieval Catholicism, especially monasticism, which was near the core of the spirituality of the Christian West and had been for most of the previous millennium. Today, though, 500 years after the start of the Reformation, in a time of religious disintegration and apostasy, I believe that the heirs of the Reformation would do well to revisit, to make a symbolic pilgrimage to Mont Saint-Michel, in part, paradoxically, to strengthen themselves, yourselves, as reformers. That is, I believe that recovering certain aspects of medieval Christianity cast aside by modernity is necessary to grounding ourselves in the historic Orthodox Christian faith, strongly enough to resist the annihilating currents of post-Christian modernity. And let me be clear, by the Reformation's heirs, I'm not only talking about Protestants. All of us Christians in the West are heirs to the Reformation, because the Reformation was probably the key event that ushered in modernity, called by Charles Taylor a secular age. Culturally and philosophically speaking, even though I said I weren't going to talk about them, I'm going to talk about them, most American Catholics and American Orthodox today are about as far from the world symbolized by Mont Saint-Michel as Protestants are. All of us need to return to the wonder. But again, today we're going to talk about Protestants. In 1904, the American writer and historian Henry Adams published his book-length essay, Mont Saint-Michel and Chartres, which he subtitled A Reflection on 13th Century Unity. In it, Adams extolled La Merveille as, quote, having solved the whole problem of the universe. God reconciles all, Adams wrote. The world is an evident, obvious, sacred harmony. Mont Saint-Michel, in Adam's view, was a symbol, is a symbol, of that sacred harmony. It was and is an icon, a material work of art that points with particular power to a divine reality. To look upon Mont Saint-Michel is to see the manifestation of fundamental metaphysical and theological truths. For Adams, the Merveille testifies to a world in which God is everywhere present and fills all things. What followed the High Middle Ages, he said, were, quote, wars of religion, dissolution of society, loss of unity, the end of a world. Adams described the wonder as a symbol of unity, an assertion of God and man in a bolder, stronger, closer union than ever was expressed by any other art. The essay reflects Adams' flight to the age of faith in reaction to the disorienting technological changes that were revolutionizing the nation and the West at the end of the 19th century. Adams could see a world in which the world in which he was raised rapidly dissolving before his eyes into chaos and dynamism. A century later, this process of dissolution and dynamism has both immensely quickened and advanced much farther than Adams could have contemplated. We small O Orthodox Christians today find ourselves facing more or less the same dilemma that preoccupied Adams, only much more intensified: how to hold on to the values of the past amid revolutionary change. In our case, this isn't merely a matter of manners and morals. This is an existential crisis. We're well into a repeat of what the Romans lived through in the 4th and 5th centuries as the certainties of 4th century as the certainties of pagan religion collapsed before their eyes in the face of the new religion called Christianity. We are not fated to repeat the experience of the pagans. But if we fail to grasp the nature and the severity of the crisis upon us now and respond appropriately to meet it, future historians may see us as being like the last pagan generations in the West. Time is running out. Well, in my remarks last night, you've heard the story. I listed some of the shocking statistics that reveal how feeble the contemporary American church is, and I don't need to rehash that here. Recall, though, that we are living in an extraordinary period of flux deemed liquid modernity by the sociologist Zygmunt Bauman. In liquid modernity, the change is so rapid that no institutions or practices have time to solidify, and there is little, if any, solid ground left. The weakness of the church's response to this was evident to me in an exchange I had earlier this spring with an undergraduate at an evangelical university. After I delivered an hour-long talk about the Benedict option and the importance of reclaiming practices and disciplines in Christian discipleship, there was a question and answer period. The first question came from an undergraduate standing in the back of the room. She said, "I don't understand why you keep talking about practices. What's wrong with loving Jesus with all my heart like I was raised to do?" Well, I was kind of struck by that because I didn't quite understand where she was coming from. And again, this is my own ignorance of popular evangelicalism, as I was told later by one of the professors. But I told this young woman that love is just an emotion and an abstraction if it isn't made concrete, including being bounded and embodied within particular disciplines and forms. Later that night after the talk, a professor at that college told me that that young woman's naive question encapsulates the worldview of 99% of the students at this conservative evangelical college. He told me that they're the products of youth groups, churches, and families that treat the faith as primarily a matter of personal piety and emotional experience. And this leads them to think, quite wrongly, that niceness is the same thing as holiness, and that moralistic therapeutic deism is the same thing as Christianity. So when the world comes around and tells them that something they believe in as Christians is mean, these kids fall like a sandcastle that has been engulfed by the incoming tide. Well, the onrushing tide of liquid modernity means that Christians today cannot live in sandcastles. We need fortresses built upon solid rock within which to shelter. We need Mont Saint-Michel. To understand why, let's think about Terrence Malick's unusual 2012 film, To the Wonder. The wonder in the film is, of course, Mont Saint-Michel, which is the film's controlling metaphor. To the Wonder is a movie about the vicissitudes of love, both human and divine, in the flux of time. The movie begins with Neil and Marina, lovers, visiting Mont Saint-Michel as tourists. We see them kissing in the enclosed courtyard of the Abbey, their love being born in a symbolic Garden of Eden. Later, the two stand on the wet sand plain between the island and the mainland. I don't know if you've ever seen anything about Mont Saint-Michel or been there, but the tide is incredibly strong. And when it goes out, it's nothing but wet sand from the island to the shore. But when it comes back in, it becomes a proper island. Well, anyway, Neil and Marina are standing on that on the wet sand with the tide out, and they frolic trying to get away from the tide when it comes back in. Later, back in Paris, where they live, the lovers stroll through the Luxembourg Gardens. Neil is an American, and he proposes to Marina that they move together to America. They do this and find themselves going from Paris to a subdivision on the bleak grasslands on the outskirts of Bartlesville, Oklahoma. In Oklahoma, Marina says to Neil, "If you love me, I need nothing else." You hear the voice of that evangelical girl in that? "If you love me, I need nothing else." But that's really not true. The feeling of love is not enough. Neil and Marina, you see that they don't really unpack their boxes. The walls of their house remain bare. That's a symbol of them not being committed to this place, which is to say, they're not really committed to each other. They're not married. Over the course of the film, they drift in and out of each other's lives as the feeling in their hearts waxes and wanes like the tide. But there's a third character in the film, a Catholic priest named Father Quintana. He serves at a dying parish church in Bartlesville. Father Quintana himself is having a profound crisis of faith. The love he once felt for God that caused him to pledge his life to the Lord and the priesthood has waned. We hear him saying in prayer, "Everywhere you're present, and still I can't see you. You're within me, around me, and I have no experience of you, not as I once did. Why don't I hold on to what I've found? My heart is cold, hard." Now that's the priest's internal voice. Outwardly, though, he's a rock. In a homily, Father Quintana preaches, "Love is not only a feeling, it is a duty. You shall love. It is a command. You feel that it has died? It is perhaps waiting to be transformed into something higher." Though the priest doesn't feel the love of God as he once did, he carries out his duties because he loves. He lives within the disciplines of his life as a priest. He continues to visit the poor, the sick, prisoners, and drug addicts. God manifests himself to Father Quintana in the faces of these people. Loving them and going through the disciplines and the motions of the priestly life, that keeps him steady through this dark night of his soul. Father Quintana is a knight of faith, ceaselessly searching for the God his faith tells him is there, even if God is, for whatever reason, elusive in this moment in Father Quintana's life. Here's the thing. The relationship between Neil and Marina cannot abide the loss of emotional feeling and cannot withstand suffering because it is dependent entirely on love as the experience of emotional feeling. They are hedgers of bets. Father Quintana, by contrast, can and does endure because his love is grounded in self-sacrificial commitment. He sees his heart, his faculties of perception, as compromised, but not his understanding of reality. When the experience of love abates, the forms and practices of a Christian priest's life hold him up and keep him going. And he does a lot of good for those people around him, humble people who are experiencing the visceral love of God and the light of the divine and in God's presence in part through Father Quintana's ministry. Even though he can't see it himself, he is a light through which the presence of God shines. In the film's final scene, we see Marina traipsing through a bleak, brown, late autumn landscape in France. And she and Neil have again separated, this time permanently, it seems. She's free to follow her passions, yes, but she's alone on what looks like a blasted heath. Symbolically, she wakes up in this final scene to a new day and is seeing the world in all its wonder. Her reaction is to twirl around and dance through it with a sense of delight as always, but with no direction. Suddenly, she whips around and is blinded by an intense, focused beam of light in her face. This is her road to Damascus moment. She will have to choose. This beam of light comes from behind, inviting her to reverse course. In other words, it tells her, you're on the wrong path, turn around, go back. The very next image after this shocking moment, the last image in the movie, shows Mont Saint-Michel in the serenity of twilight. We're given to understand that the living God is calling Marina, sending light out of the eternal darkness and the great silence. The same God to whom the stones and the glass and the spires of the wonder of Mont Saint-Michel bear witness and have borne witness since the Middle Ages. Now, watching the film To the Wonder and its effect on my own life in a spiritual crisis and what it caused me, how it caused me to reflect on what I needed to do to be faithful to God and obey him in a time of great distress, led me to choose Mont Saint-Michel as the cover image of the Benedict option. Because in this movie, To the Wonder, I see the dilemma facing Christians in our post-Christian world. True, navigating the stormy waters of love, love of God, love of others, is a challenge in every time and place. But Christians in the 21st century face unprecedented difficulties. To the Wonder is a parable about how we should and how we should not face them. I mentioned earlier, of course, Bauman and the liquid modernity theory, because it's like today in trying to build fortresses or places of stability in our parishes in liquid modernity, it's like trying to build igloos in the summertime. Most people might think this is a good thing. In the past, even in solid modernity, there was hierarchy and structure. Our lives were bound by the commitments we made or that we received willingly on behalf of the tradition in which we were formed. Today, though, most people think of themselves as authors of our own lives and identities. We are free, like Marina, to go and do whatever we want. And this, of course, is what Charles Taylor meant by saying we live in a secular age. Not that everybody is secular all of a sudden, but that we live in a time in which, even if we are religious, we're aware, we cannot be unaware that it's a choice, that we might choose otherwise. I mean, and as Joel was saying, I started out, I was born into Methodism, I became a Roman Catholic, and now I'm Eastern Orthodox. This is the story for about, I think the Pew Center said, over 40% of American adults today are not the religion into which they were born. Don't look to me as an icon of stability here. I mean, we're all living in this world. But in his rule, St. Benedict, as I said last night, condemned the Gyrovagues, monks who flitted from monastery to monastery, staying only long enough to get bored, then moving on to the next one. These were the worst kind of monk, the saint said. They live parasitically off the commitments of others and the structures others maintain. To combat the Gyrovagues, Benedict compelled his monks to take vows of stability, that is, to vow to stay in the monastery they entered until the day they die. Only through this solid and sacrificial commitment could they grow spiritually. Only by making a covenant with these particular people in this particular place, sanctified by God, would they have the wherewithal to bear suffering as Christians. Remember that Benedictine monasticism emerged in the decades immediately following the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West. Chaos and instability, that was part of everyday life. Benedictine monasteries were meant to be communities and places of resistance. And I want to clarify, they weren't built as we will resist. They were built because the monks were seeking God and seeking how to serve him in this time and place. And monastic life came out of that. In liquid modernity, or you can call it post-modernity, we're all Gyrovagues to some extent. As I said, I'm no different from anybody else. And I don't presume to lecture from a position of superiority, moral or otherwise. All of us are caught in this and catechized by the culture of liquid modernity. But if we don't consciously resist it, we can't help but drifting into gyrovagary, because that's a reasonable response to this world. In Bauman's pitiless analysis, to succeed today, you need to be free of all commitments, unbound by the past or the future, and living in an everlasting present. Instead of believing that structure is good and that duties to home and to family and to church lead us to live rightly, people today have been catechized by liquid modernity into believing that maximizing individual happiness should be the goal of life. We see this in moralistic therapeutic deism, where the highest thing we look for is happiness. We think God wants us to be happy, whatever that's going to be. Well, yes, God does want us to be happy, but he wants us to be holy above all. But we've lost that today. The Geirrweg, the villain in St. Benedict's rule, is the hero of postmodernity. Bauman says something really interesting after that. He says that prior to liquid modernity, people experienced life as a pilgrimage. Mont-Saint-Michel is a pilgrimage site and has been for many centuries, and this is generally how most people experience life. You had a destination, and that destination made it possible to measure the distance you traveled or failed to travel. The destination gives purpose and weight to the journey, as does the knowledge that those who came before us in time made the same journey, as will our children and our children's children. All of this keeps us properly oriented, no matter how many twists and turns the path takes along the way. You went on this journey with others who helped you along the way and were helped by you. The pilgrim expects hardship along the way because that is normal. But the destination and the holiness of the destination, the eschatology here, makes that hardship bearable, as does the sure knowledge that our fellow pilgrims are sharing our suffering, and that previous pilgrims have suffered too, but they made it to the destination all the same. And finally, a world filled with pilgrims is a world that makes itself hospitable to pilgrims, because we all depend on the mercy of others. Bauman is still alive today. He's in his 90s. He's certainly no Christian, but you can see in this model of pilgrims versus tourists how the Christian life fits into the pilgrim model. In fact, the only way we can situate ourselves rightly as a Christian is within the narrative of pilgrimage. A religious tourist, the person who flits from here to there, taking only what they like and cobbling together a spirituality out of that, cannot ultimately be a serious Christian. Moralistic therapeutic deism, that's religious tourism. But the dangerous thing about it is that Christians of the future will come to think of this pseudo-Christianity as a pilgrimage and lose the cultural memory of what it once meant and has always meant to be a Christian. In other words, if the journey we have to take, if our pilgrimage is wholly individual and there are no markers by which to judge how we've gone and there's no map, we make up the map as we go along, that can't ever be a pilgrimage properly seen. I think today, again, most of us Christians have lost the sense of ourselves as pilgrims. The destination is really ourselves. We may say it's God, but it's really ourselves and the satisfaction of our own desires. True, you can't tell whether or not you're making progress or just going in circles, but it doesn't really matter because there's no place you have to be anyway. Just keep moving. The green light is always there. Just keep going. The one thing you must not do as a tourist is to tie yourself down to a place or the people in it, because that would limit your freedom of movement and it could cost you plenty. Loyalty to people, places, and ideas keeps you from being able to take advantage of new opportunities, and it cements you in place once you get bored or unhappy there, as you will. Everything is temporary. Everything can be negotiated. Nothing is permanent. The tourist does not live his life as a continuous story, but as a series of disconnected moments. The past doesn't matter to the tourist, nor does the future. The tourist's life is an everlasting now. He's always keeping his options open. And I got to tell you, this is the way I've lived for most of my life because I didn't know any better. You know, I aside from religious tourism, I traveled all over the country in search of better jobs, search of more opportunities. And after I got married, I uprooted my family several times. But it took the death of my sister in small town Louisiana, where we were raised, for me to realize what the cost of my Geirrweg-ery was. Now, I moved back down there and planted myself in my family's hometown, but I also found out, if you've read my other books, that I had made an idol of those places too. And so this was all very, very instructive and painful to me to understand. But I think in many ways the journey I've had to make within myself from being a tourist to learning what it really meant to be a pilgrim is instructive, I hope, for all of us. A world made for tourists, though, is very different from a world made for pilgrims. It's a world whose structures, whose economy, whose customs, whose religion, whose schools, and so forth, reward tourism and discourage abiding in pilgrimage. Something as simple as the free trade agreements, for example, that incentivize people who own industries moving out to a place where they can manufacture cheaper, that collapses communities. You don't need to go further than the Rust Belt to know that there's a cost to those kind of freedoms. To be a pilgrim in a world made for tourism is to take on an extraordinary burden. Liquid modernity is like this catastrophic flood that has swallowed up all the trail markers. The Christian who wants to live as a pilgrim under these conditions has to have a reliable map. He has to have the examples of others, both today and in the past, having made the pilgrimage successfully. And he needs a community of fellow pilgrims for help and encouragement. And he needs to have rock-solid confidence that his journey has meaning, because that faith may be the only thing that keeps him moving when everyone around him fails and he begins to doubt his purpose, like Father Quintana. That is to say, the pilgrim must believe in the integrity of the journey, even though it will cause him to suffer. In liquid modernity, asceticism, choosing suffering for the sake of a higher purpose, makes no sense at all. We're used to comfort. We think suffering makes no sense. And so we try to avoid it and move off the path if we can avoid suffering in that way. Above all, do not delay gratification if you can help it, says Zygmunt Bauman. Whatever you're after, try to get it now, because you cannot know whether the gratification you seek today will still be gratifying tomorrow. Well, that brings us to the contrasting examples and to the wonder. Neil and Marina, as I've said, are tourists. They are the products of this world. Their love is real in that they really do feel a passionate attachment to each other, but they refuse to ground it in any kind of commitment or in a covenant, in the covenant of marriage, and the daily practices, including dying to oneself and overcoming one's own passions, one's own disordered passions, that would give their love durable expression and resilience when those emotions recede. Theirs is a house built on sand. Marina's statement early in the film that love is all she needs is pretty much the same question or the same statement that I received from that evangelical undergraduate. But by contrast, Father Quintana's love, in his case, a love of God, that is love established on solid rock. He is suffering the pain of the loss of that love he once knew. Where is that love now? Father Quintana can't find it, but he knows it is there, because he anchored that love in a sacred covenant and as the heir to this rich Roman Catholic tradition that has endured over these many centuries and that has shown people, pilgrims who've come before him, how to make it there, what the way is. And because over the years he has made that feeling incarnate by his practices, the priest has created a habitus in which he can hold on to that truth in a time of testing. He's no tourist, Father Quintana. Rather, he's a suffering pilgrim, pouring himself out for the active loves of those around him. And that makes all the difference. One thing that helped bring me out of my own despair and my own having lost the straight path through life was reading the Divine Comedy. I wrote a book about this, but it was fascinating to me to see that in the Inferno, one thing that characterizes all the damned is that they are perfectly the masters of their own lives. They have become fully autonomous individuals. They chose their sin over God and over anybody else. Thus, God gives them what they want. In hell, they are cut off forever from everybody else, from God and everybody else, and that is their judgment. But when you go into the Purgatorio, the march up the holy mountain, that is when community gets reborn. Everybody knows that they're going someplace definite, and that they have to go together, and that they have to help each other to get there. You become more and more human and more godlike, more like God, filled with the Holy Spirit, the more you reach out to others and help them on the way. And that's the secret of life right there. Individualism, as we have it, and having pure autonomy, is the road to hell. That's not what we're taught by our culture today. At one point in the film, Father Quintana preaches this to his congregation. Man is in revolt against God. The prophet Hosea saw in the breakdown of his marriage the spiritual infidelity of his people. In that broken marriage, we see the pattern of our world. We wish to live within the safety of the laws. We fear to choose. Jesus insists on choice. The one thing he condemns utterly is avoiding the choice. To choose is to commit yourself, and to commit yourself is to run the risk of failure, the risk of sin, the risk of betrayal. But Jesus can deal with all of those. Forgiveness, he never denies us. The man who makes a mistake can repent. But the man who hesitates, who does nothing, who buries his talent in the earth, with him, he can do nothing. Well, Neil is sitting in the congregation listening to this sermon, and you can see on his face that this is piercing his heart. But it doesn't change him. He's like, you know, the rich young ruler who listens to this wisdom and walks away. He still hesitates in all things to preserve his autonomy and liberty. Marina, by contrast, is all undisciplined passion. Sometimes she'll return to the Eucharist, but it's as temporary as her commitment to Neil. Both of them remain Gyrovegs of love. Quintana, though, the priest, has that stability. He's firmly rooted in that tradition, its culture, and its practices. And it's important to note that Father Quintana does not enact the rituals and habits of his Catholic tradition as if they were ends in themselves. If he did, he would be spiritually dead, even if he lived by all those laws. Rather, he treats those traditions, those practices, as guide rails and signposts that keep him on the straight path, even though he is treading it on a moonless night. In the story of To the Wonder, Mont-Saint-Michel stands for the abiding presence of God. The tide surrounding the island comes in and the tide goes out, but its oscillations do not affect the Benedictine Abbey established atop the rock. That abbey stands for stability. It stands for eternity and God's presence eternally among us. It is a sacred symbol. In the history of the medieval cathedral at Chartres, Philip Ball writes that every part of the building, quote, had the primary function of expressing piety and encoding a belief in the divine order. It unites the physical with the metaphysical. According to Abbot Suger, who is the originator of Gothic architecture, building a church involved the transposition of the material into the spiritual. The medieval abbey of Mont-Saint-Michel is not a sacrament necessarily, but it is sacramental. That is, it's a place where the love of God and a certain idea of God's order and will for the world is made concrete. It is an attempt to incarnate in stone and glass a vision of the eternal and of the eternal God who is love itself. The film To the Wonder is an answer, not the answer, but an answer, and a good one, I think, to the question that the evangelical undergraduate asked. Why isn't it enough to love Jesus with all my heart? If that love of Christ, which has to be real, is to endure at all, it has to take some kind of material form. And that form cannot be protean. It doesn't have to be high Gothic, but it does have to be solid and certain and reliable. And it must be meaningful with the Logos embedded in it. The structures of all our life, the liturgies of our life, the buildings, the ritual, the practices must point us toward God. This is what the rule of St. Benedict teaches. The Reformed theologian Hans Boersma argues in his book Heavenly Participation that all Christians today have to work towards recapturing a sense of the sacramental, of God's presence imminent among us. Hans Boersma writes, "The purpose of all matter is to lead us into God's heavenly presence, to bring about communion with God and participation in the divine life. Thus are the Church's sacraments simply the beginning of the cosmic restoration. The entire cosmos is meant to serve as a sacrament, a material gift from God, in and through which we enter into the joy of his heavenly presence." When you walk into a medieval cathedral or a basilica or an abbey, you know, the whole thing is a representation of the cosmos, their attempt to represent the cosmos. And in the Orthodox Church, it may be true in the Catholic Church, I just don't know, I didn't study Catholic theology enough to know, but in the Orthodox Church, when you go into the divine liturgy, the Orthodox see that liturgy as being as an eternally being in the presence of God, or rather an expression of the eternal in the temporal. It is not just something we do to uplift ourselves. It is an encounter with the eternal God. Boersma notes that this sacramental ontology, as he calls it, was common to all Christians in the first millennium. He calls this the great tradition and urges his fellow evangelicals to rediscover it. In the Benedict option, I present monastic spirituality as a good model for us lay Christians today, not because I believe that we're all called to live as monks or nuns, but because the Benedictines, as I said last night, construct everything they do and order everything by Christ and to Christ. That is, they build a world both externally and internally in which they try to harmonize the physical in all ways with the divine unseen order. Well, why is this so important right here and right now? Because the statistics overwhelmingly show that the church in the West is in deep crisis. Not only are we hemorrhaging people, but those that stay are losing the ability to determine what is authentically Christian and what isn't. We live in a culture in which the most powerful cultural forces are toward emotivism, disintegration, and fragmentation. Everything is up for grabs, and as the Anglican Ephraim Radner has said, not even our churches are safe places. Our passions are not ordered rightly. And in fact, our disordered passions order everything else, order the world around us. Everything is turned upside down. Father Cassian Folsom, who refounded that Benedictine monastery in Norcia, told me that Christians who don't live out some form of the Benedict option are not going to make it, and they're not going to make it because we don't have a strong place on which to stand. This is not the place to go into the details of the Benedict option. I did that last night. But Rowan Williams, of all people, provides a concise summation of it in his review of the book in the current issue of New Statesman. He says that the Benedict option is about developing, quote, a more densely textured religious life in which regular patterns of communal prayer and intellectual and spiritual development will keep alive the possibility of inhabiting a nourishing, morally rich tradition. Christians ought to be more like Orthodox Jews or conscientious Muslims, living visibly at an angle to the practices of contemporary society. I think that's really, really nice. I wish I'd thought of those words myself. But notice he says this will only keep alive the possibility of inhabiting that world. We have to choose, as Father Quintana said, what we can do for ourselves and for our children and our children's children is keep alive that possibility of making the faith a possibility for them. And we do that by creating the world around them that forms them. There are good sociological reasons for embracing a more sacramental Christian life and thicker community grounded in the great tradition. As I think I mentioned yesterday, the Cambridge social anthropologist Paul Connerton studied communities that have been successful at coming through modernity with their traditions more or less intact. They have several characteristics in common. They're bound by a sacred story. They gather in commemorative ceremonies to reenact that story, not just tell the story, but to reenact it. The story has to convey metaphysical truth, and its reenactment must, in some mystical sense, bring eternity into the present. And finally, the ritual reenactment of the sacred story involves not just the mind, but the body. Without those elements, we're totally vulnerable. It should be said that ceremony, sacramentalism, and outward forms are not enough on their own. If they were, the liturgical churches would be weathering the storm very well, and evangelical churches would be alone in the crisis. In fact, in many ways, evangelicalism is doing better than the liturgical churches. I see no reason at all for triumphalism from the older sisters in the faith, in Catholicism and Orthodoxy. But that said, I believe that evangelicalism is more vulnerable than many of the evangelicals, the everyday evangelicals I meet, understand. For one, its total focus on evangelizing causes it to neglect contemplation. We cannot bring to the world a gospel that we don't have. An evangelical friend of mine told me that we in the evangelical churches are very good at making converts, but lousy at forming disciples. When I hear over and over again from professors at evangelical colleges that their students show up on campus enthusiastic for Christ, but knowing next to nothing about Christian doctrine, I see disaster looming. Now, it's a wonderful thing to love Christ emotionally. We have to do that. But emotions come and go. If the experience of emotions associated with love is the sum total of our Christianity, if the sum total of our Christianity is that Jesus is our best friend, then we cannot be pilgrims, only tourists. We will seek novelty and call that love. Here's a true story, and this it really kind of shakes me to think about this. I recently ran into an elderly Southern gentleman I know to be the pillar of his evangelical church. He is a staunch evangelical who can't run into you without telling you, Jesus loves you and I love you too. Mr. Jimmy, as I'll call him, is a really good man who lives with true fervor for Christ. Well, we got to talking about what was happening in all the churches, and he told me how upset he was that his own children, who are my age, we were in school together, aren't teaching their children, his grandchildren, about Christian sexual ethics. He's just leaving them wide open to the world. And I said, oh, that's such a shame. That's such a shame. Well, then we started talking about same-sex marriage. And he told me that he expects it to come to his denomination, too. I said, oh, Mr. Jimmy, that's such a shame. No, it's not, son, he told me. I'm all for it. It's about love, Rod. It's all about love. My God would not turn those people away if they came to get married in my church. I was stunned by this, and I changed the subject because I couldn't believe what I was hearing. This is a man who's the same age as my parents. And I thought, if we've lost Mr. Jimmy, we've lost, period. And we have lost Mr. Jimmy because of a misguided but common view of Christian love. Related to this is the fact that propositional truth and arguments no longer matter as much as they used to. It used to be key to evangelicalism, but at this point in postmodernity, people don't have the ears to hear it. Pope Benedict XVI said once that the greatest argument the church has for itself is not its syllogisms, but the art it produces and the saints it generates. What he means is that people are not primarily moved by reason. They are first struck by beauty and goodness, that is, attributes of God made incarnate. Beauty and goodness then serve as gateways to the truth. This is simply part of human nature, and it's far more true in a time like ours when reason is so feeble. It is true that we cannot abandon evangelism and we can't abandon making these public arguments for the faith, but the forms our evangelism takes will have to change. Any Christian who wants to evangelize effectively and disciple effectively in liquid modernity is going to have to allow the things Christians create, the way Christians live, and the good deeds Christians do speak for him and for the experience of Jesus. And this is going to require discipleship. Disciples are formed via disciplines. We are what we pay attention to. The disciplines of the Christian life, both the things we take on and the things we refuse, are absolutely essential in a world without discipline, in a world where we follow our passions, because that's supposedly what makes us authentic. This is not works righteousness. We are not earning our salvation, but rather we are training our spiritual and moral muscles to serve God under very adverse conditions. Finally, evangelicalism is very outward-looking and missional. There may be no more active Christians in the universal church, but in their busyness in the world, evangelicals do tend to downplay contemplation and aspects of the contemplative life. I have a seeker friend who has been through a number of churches, most of them evangelical or charismatic, and he even flirted with Islam, trying to find solid ground. He still, to this day, hasn't found what he's looking for. He's a dear, loving man, but he can't rest. As soon as that warm spiritual feeling is gone, he starts looking for the exits and doesn't understand what's wrong with it. He doesn't understand why God hasn't given him a place to rest. But I look at his family, and I see how his wife and children have fallen away from the church, and I see that the cost of his spiritual gyrovagary is not just to himself, but to his wife and kids, and any kids they may have, because they're not gonna be raised in the church. But if you spent any time with this guy, you would recognize how big-hearted he is, give you the shirt right off his back. But all that fine feeling is useless without stability. In fact, more than useless, because the witness of his deeds has convinced his wife and kids that religion is just daddy's weird hobby and not to be taken seriously. By contrast, the monks in Norcia receive pilgrims all the time, and they offer them spiritual counsel. What people don't appreciate is that in order to be for those pilgrims who Christ commands him to be in the monastic vocation requires an enormous amount of time spent behind those walls in contemplation and fasting and Lectio Divina and so forth. They go into the great silence of the monastery in part so they can faithfully bear Christ to the world in their encounters. And we see that in Father Quintana when he goes to visit the prisoners. They can see the light of Christ in him even though he doesn't see it coming out of them because he prays, because he does his duty in love. Whatever they tell you in answer to your questions, the monks of Norcia, you can viscerally tell that it comes from a place of depth and solidity and seriousness. I don't know that I've ever seen Christians who are as joyful as they are, but also as serene. Very few Christians are called to be monks, but all Christians are called to bear witness to Christ. In a post-Christian world, we have to spend much more time away from the world in various ways in our own Mont Saint-Michels in order to build up our spiritual strength so that when we go into the world, we can represent our Lord faithfully. I told the story last night about Jeremiah 29 and how we have to be in the world and embedded in the world, but we also have to be like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and know when we have to say we will go no farther. We will die before we will apostatize. We had better be asking ourselves what it was they had that gave them the strength to do that when they were put to the test. Because winsomeness, that's not going to cut it. We're at a time in history of the church in the West where we need much more emphasis on the contemplative. G.K. Chesterton, in his biography of St. Francis we were talking about this morning, wrote, "What St. Benedict has stored, St. Francis scattered." That is, St. Benedict responded to the needs of his time and place, the 6th century and the shards and ruins of the Roman Empire, by undertaking the work of storing up seeds. But by the time St. Francis was born in the late 12th century, the church needed something very different. Both men were the saints at their age needed. In the future, the West will have need of a St. Francis. Indeed, as Kevin and I and David were talking this morning, we need some aspects of St. Francis right now. But today, our greatest need is for St. Benedict and the Benedictine virtues. We need to store up the seeds for a day when the ground is fertile enough to receive them. To this end, the early church historian Robert Louis Wilkin has written, "Nothing is more needful today than the survival of Christian culture, because in recent generations, this culture has become dangerously thin. At this moment in the church's history, in this country and in the West more generally, it is less urgent to convince the alternative culture in which we live of the truth of Christ than it is for the church to tell itself its own story and to nurture its own life, the culture of the city of God, the Christian Republic. This is not going to happen without a rebirth of moral and spiritual discipline and a resolute effort on the part of Christians to comprehend and to defend the remnants of Christian culture. If Christian culture is to be renewed, habits are more vital than revivals, rituals more edifying than spiritual highs, the creed more penetrating than theological insight, and the celebration of saints' days more uplifting than the observance of Mother's Day." What role do the Reformation churches have to play in this common Christian mission to ground ourselves in a world that lacks permanence, continuity, and structure? Well, earlier this year, as I said, Al Mohler asked me if I thought evangelicals had what it took to do the Benedict option. And he, of course, said, if we return to our Reformation roots, we will. Well, I'm a journalist, and I'm not a scholar, and I don't know enough about evangelicalism or magisterial Protestantism to guess what Mohler means by this. But I suspect he's first of all concerned that contemporary evangelicalism is thin on resources with which to meet the particular challenge of liquid modernity. The question of why isn't it enough to love Jesus with all our hearts encapsulates both the strength and the weakness of evangelicalism today. The strength is a desire to love Christ with everything one has, a desire that is sadly harder to find outside of evangelicalism and Pentecostalism. But the weakness is a belief that that desire is sufficient. I'd like to close on a hopeful note today by quoting the Westminster Shorter Catechism, in which it says that the chief end of man is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. The Reformed Christian theologian Michael Allen, in a review of the Benedict option, writes that the glory of God is our chief end, such that it orients all other ends, and therefore the glory of God is our chief end, such that it orients all other ends, and therefore has universal significance as we think about the deployment of our minds and our bodies, our affections and our reason, our relationships and our work, our resources and our time, our churches and our communities, our families and our frustrations. A Benedictine abbot could not agree more. Professor Allen adds that classical Reformed Christianity identifies the church as the chief mean of forming Christians. He writes, "Durer is right to observe that the churches must be communities of spiritual formation if other networks, associations, and families are to be transformed. Thick discipleship must take the form, then, of fostering deeper commitment to the ministry of the means of grace and the rhythms of congregational life and witness." Well, that short reflection by this Reformed professor gives me confidence that Protestants do have within their tradition resources adequate to meet the crisis. To be honest, I certainly welcome evangelicals who convert to orthodoxy, but I'm realistic enough to know that this is not going to be the path of most. If evangelicals are going to hold fast against the raging currents of liquid modernity, they're probably going to do so as evangelical Protestants. It will be up to pastors, theologians and other thought leaders within Protestantism to embrace a ressourcement within the great tradition, and not a bricolage of cherry-picked ancient prayers and practices, but something more organically rooted in the magisterial Reformation and in the early church. Alistair MacIntyre said, as you know, that we await a new and doubtless very different Saint Benedict. I believe that the Saint Benedicts we need to guide us through this dark age might come from Rome, yes, but also from Constantinople, from Moscow, from Geneva, from Wittenberg and Canterbury. We all must make a return pilgrimage to the wonder that is Almighty God and who has been there waiting for us all along. Will the Reformation churches have what it takes to make it through this long day's journey through the night ahead? That's not for me to say, but I know that we all have to try. Thank you very much.
The Ancient Evangelical Future Conference is hosted annually by the Robert E. Weber Center at Trinity School for Ministry. This recording is a production of Whitchurch Publishing, trusted resources from Trinity School for Ministry, all rights reserved. Visit us on the web at www.tsm.edu.